Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEddin.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEddin.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEddin.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently.
This is Jeff Deist, and you're listening to the Human Action Podcast. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back once again to the Human Action Podcast. It's great to have you with us this weekend. Our guest is a returning guest, Dr. Saifedean Ammous. He's actually been on the show a couple times. We covered his Bitcoin Standard book, which was obviously a revolutionary and seminal work a couple of years ago. More recently, I believe in the fall of 2020, we discussed his upcoming Principles of Economics textbook, which was kind of a unique project. But he's got another project. This book is called The Fiat Standard, The Debt Slavery Alternative to Human Civilization. And in typical Saifedean fashion, he is not going the traditional route. He is writing this book, rewriting it, going through drafts. Some of his subscribers have earlier access to certain chapters. So he's not going about it as a typical fiat academic, and we'll explain what that means here perhaps in a bit. So all that said, Saif, it's great to hear your voice again.
Thank you very much for having me, Jeff. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, you know, I was interested in looking at this book. I guess first and foremost, I was wondering, did you decide originally to do it in some sort of serialized format? Are you trying to continually revise it, source, crowdsource comments, that sort of thing? Will there ultimately be a print version of the book?
Yes, there will be a print version coming out in December, just in time for Christmas. But I thought the traditional academic way is that you publish papers and you discuss them with your colleagues and you get feedback on them and then you revise and then you turn them into a book. But I think the internet allows us to be far more efficient than that system. And with a kind of entrepreneurial take on things, which is that ultimately I'm writing for my readers, and I could have it so that I'm sending the early chapters, the drafts of the chapters, the first draft of each chapter out to my readers. And those are likely to be the most interested, most loyal readers, the ones that are going to subscribe on my website. So these are the ones that I care about the most. And so their feedback is highly appreciated. So I sent it out to subscribers over the past, what is it now, 8-9 months, one chapter every 2 weeks, alternating with Principles of Economics, which I'm also coming close to finishing up. And I've been getting feedback on it and revising it as I go along. And now it's very close to done.
Yeah, this seems like a much better system, because if you're writing a book over a period of a year or two, things change. New facts come to light. We don't have to live in this old analog world anymore.
Yeah, can keep changing and updating and taking on feedback.
And did you decide on this with an eye towards the 50th anniversary of 1971, or is the book coming out in 21 just a happy circumstance?
No, it was really just serendipity, I think. I came across the idea of writing this book after I'd written the Bitcoin Standard, and I saw somebody, one of the Bitcoin people named Giacomo Zucco, who was doing a presentation of trying to understand altcoins and trying to make the case for altcoins. And that approach kind of struck me as being interesting. You know, look at something, try and make the case for something that you don't like in order to try and understand it properly. And so I thought, and I'd already had a bunch of writings and a bunch of ideas that I wanted to write about after I'd finished the Bitcoin Standard. So this this came to me as a good way of packaging all of these ideas, which is, you know, the Bitcoin Standard introduced Bitcoin, and the Fiat Standard is going to discuss how Bitcoin rises, coexists, or dethrones the fiat system. And so I thought the best way to begin would be to just study the fiat system from scratch in the same way that I studied the Bitcoin. You know, the Bitcoin was written for people who had no idea what Bitcoin is. And I tried to get together the economic, technical, and societal and political aspects and the significance of Bitcoin to all of those fields and try and put them into one coherent narrative. And so I thought, I'll try and do the same with fiat. And it's come along nicely. I've been working on this for maybe 3 years now.
Well, it's interesting. What I was struck reading this over the weekend is that you sort of turned things on their head. The Bitcoin Standard was written with a lot of theory and history about the past and fiat, and then introduced Bitcoin conceptually in the latter part of the book. Whereas this almost starts with an understanding of Bitcoin, especially in some of your chapter titles and some of your nomenclature. And then it goes back and explains fiat. So it's almost like Bitcoin's the standard now, and fiat's the crazy aberration that we need to understand.
Yeah, and I think this is probably going to age well, because I think in the future, it's going to be much harder to explain fiat to people than Bitcoin. And I think this kind of approach, because I think Bitcoin is just, first of all, it's more logical and rational as a system, because it was designed by a computer scientist to serve the core essential functions of what you would want from a monetary system. And so it's really bare bones and very clear if you really get under the hood and study the technical aspects of it. Whereas the fiat system, you know, it was the emergent bastard child, really, of 80 years of government defaults and financing war and propaganda and lies. So it's not really designed very intelligently. And the drawing, you know, the analytical lens of the first part of the book is to think of fiat as a digital currency, which it is, after all. You know, a small fraction of fiat money is printed out into pieces of paper, but the vast majority is digital. And so if this was an altcoin, and it was, you know, you had to study it as a, to write a paper about it for your university or for your job, What would it look like? How does it work? And by drawing analogy with the constituent parts of Bitcoin, you can get very good insight into how fiat actually works.
Yeah, this was fascinating for me because we imagine that fiat is designed. We spend all this time trying to understand the plumbing of central banks and how money moves and how international settlement takes place and all that. And you imagine that there's some sort of there behind it all. But really, as you point out, this is ad hoc. It was political. It wasn't really designed. And I think what you explained so nicely is that fiat is born out of default, right? It's an entire 20th century where you discuss the Bank of England, but also, of course, the U.S. Fed, defaulting on their promises to deliver gold in exchange for paper. That's the essence of the fiat model.
Exactly. I think the key idea is that it is just a default that has not been formalized. These institutions had liabilities where they said, you know, you give us a piece of paper, you give us one of our pieces of paper, we'll give you a piece of gold back in return. And it's just been like the deadbeat friend who just keeps giving you stories about why he can't get you your money back. It's been like that for a century now, of just more elaborate reasons why, no, you can't have your gold back, and no, you have to take our paper. And our paper has to continue to decline in value, and we're going to keep making more and more of it to finance government spending. It's just an endless series of really patches and workarounds to make this system trudge along. But, you know, to be fair, it has stumbled along over the past few decades, and it is kind of working. So, you know, it bears looking into what is it that makes it tick. Why it works.
I think some of your readers are going to be surprised, actually, by your treatment of fiat and your understanding of it, and also by your treatment of gold at the very end of the book and its liquidity. So there might be some surprises in store for even the most hardcore safe readers. But I want to let you talk about two concepts which are very important in the beginning of this book, and I think you laid them out really well. The idea of saleability across time and the idea of saleability across space. So we have one where we think of hardness and gold, and then we have one where we think of fiat. So explain what these two concepts are for our readers who maybe aren't familiar with your work, and also how Bitcoin attempts to fix this.
Yeah, so the main idea around which the Bitcoin standard was written is the concept of saleability across time, which refers to how well, you know, the concept of saleability is Menger's explanation of the essential property of money. The quintessential property of money is that it is the most saleable good. It's the one that you're able to sell with the least loss of value at any particular time, with the least loss of market price, because the good is highly liquid. There are a lot of potential counterparties available for you. That's why your $100 bill is much more liquid than, you know, $100 shoe, because it's not easy to sell a $100 shoe to somebody who wants it when you want it. So in the Bitcoin standard, I explained saleability across time with reference to how well things hold on to their value. And I argue that the most important metric is arguably the stock to flow, or the inverse of the growth rate, the supply growth rate. So a money that has a very fast supply growth rate is just going to continue to be devalued over time, and value stored in it is going to be dissipated onto the new holders. And so it won't hold on to its value well across time. So it's not very saleable across time. If you hold on to fiat across decades, it doesn't hold its value very well. Gold does that better, and Bitcoin has been doing that even better over the past decade or so. But in the fiat standard, I focus on saleability across space, which is the similar concept, but it refers to how much you lose as you move the money across space. And I think this is really the key analytical framework that allows us to understand why fiat survived. And so it's true that it is an imposition on the market. It's not been chosen on the market, and yet it has worked for 50 years. And I think, you know, when you think about it from the perspective of saleability across space, you can see why it has worked for 50 years. And that's because, ultimately, the alternatives that we had are not highly saleable across space. In particular, gold and silver it's very expensive to move gold around. It's really expensive to ship $1 billion worth of gold across the Atlantic. When the German Central Bank repatriated its gold from the Federal Reserve a few years ago, it cost them something like $9 million to get their gold, well, from New York and from France. And then, of course, the only way that you can truly guarantee its purity is that you have to melt it down and pour it into new bars, which is a huge complex operation. That's really the only way that you can guarantee the purity of a gold bar. So that's highly inconvenient if you, and that's ultimately why governments were able to impose their inferior their money that's inferior in its saleability across time. They were able to impose it on the market because the alternative was extremely not saleable across space. It's not easy to move gold around. And ultimately, you can't really move it around without the permission of governments who control national borders in the 20th century. And you can't just build a, an underground gold or a, a gray market. Let's not say black market. A gray market gold settlement network is not something you can do. You know, you can't just get on an airplane with a couple of hundred pounds of gold across the Atlantic, drop them off at the bank. If gold was easier to move around, if gold was cheaper and faster to move around, it would have been more difficult for governments to force people to continue to use their terribly inflationary money. But ultimately, the only way that you could send value across national borders was that you had to go through the what I call your local fiat node, to borrow Bitcoin nomenclature, your local central bank. You have no choice except going through your central bank. And all of the banking functions in a country are built around the national currency, and they're not built around gold. And you can't just build a gold bank. And people who have tried have not succeeded, not because the market rejected it, but because governments rejected it. So that, I think, really helps us understand why, you know, that's, in a sense, the redeeming feature of fiat, or I shouldn't even say redeeming, because it wouldn't be chosen on the market on its own. But that's really what allowed it to get away with banning gold.
Right. And but as you point out in Chapter 3, it's not pure fiat. It's not pure decree. Governments have to create a market by accepting other governments' money and exchanging it. So that's a bit of a nod to, I won't call it the success of central banks, but in other words, they have cobbled together a system which has worked. And in part, they've had to have a market, for example, for US dollars to make it work.
The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on saifedean.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures, each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September, 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart, to ensure learners can attend from all over the world. I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats. Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as the fiat standard and the Bitcoin standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last with an ice-colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now.
Yeah, ultimately, all fiat central banks there is no such a thing as a pure fiat money in that, you know, some guy wakes up and prints up a bunch of papers or creates digital entries and then just tells the world, well, or tells their country, this is the money that we're going to use. There's always backing. There's always a currency backing it. So every fiat currency either has gold in reserve or it has another currency that also has gold in reserve. And in fact, the way that the United States dollar became the world's reserve currency, the world's top fiat currency, was precisely because it was the U.S. had accumulated an enormous amount of gold in World War One and World War Two, and during the Great Depression, because of the massive flight of gold from Europe because of the two wars. And so it's ultimately down to gold. The role that fiat has, the monetary role that fiat has, comes from the fact that they had the most gold. The Americans had the most gold. And before that, it was the English who had, you know, the Central Bank of England had a global gold settlement network that it operated, which was the biggest and most important in the world.
Well, and as you point out, of course, this whole thing isn't costless, and we pay the price on, I guess, what we can call the saleability across time, inflation. Fiat isn't very hard. And so could you just give us a quick detour into your, I think, excellent takedown of CPI in Chapter 4, and also why Michael Saylor, CEO of MicroStrategy, thinks maybe we ought to look at prices in terms of individual specific vectors?
Yeah. So I've explained the kind of engineering trade-off that fiat takes, but I don't think that it is a smart trade-off, because ultimately what happens is that we're witnessing all of the downsides of fiat, which I'll discuss in a minute. We're paying all of that price as an alternative for the expensive settlement of gold. And so gold settlement might be expensive, but it is infinitely cheaper than all of the damage that fiat money does. And, you know, Mises had a quote along those lines, but it was about the cost of production of gold. But I think it's equally applicable to the settlement of gold. It is expensive, just like with Bitcoin, but the expense is worth it, because the alternative is that we have easy money, and the costs of easy money are far, far outweigh the benefits, the costs of expensive settlement. So it's by no means a smart or sane engineering trade-off. It's the kind that can only be taken by a government. But the implication, of course, is, you know, the first and most obvious one is that the value of the money is constantly declining. And if you think of it from an Austrian perspective, there's no reason why the money supply should increase. You know, you could cap the money supply in any country today and the economy would adjust. And as we see with Bitcoin, you know, the economy grows far faster than the supply grows, and it doesn't seem to be hampering the economy's enormous growth, which has averaged 200% per year over the past decade. So there's, you know, Bitcoin is empirical proof that you don't need the money supply to grow at a rate similar to the growth of the economy, because we see it in front of us. And so when you think of it this way, you know, there's really no reason for the fiat money supply to increase. If you wanted to run a sane fiat money system, and you just had your own currency, you would just limit the supply. You would keep the supply fixed, and then the value of the money would appreciate over time. So all of the increase in the supply of the money is essentially devaluation of the existing holder's money. And so regardless of what happens with consumer prices, the holders of the money are still being expropriated. You know, the supply of your money is increasing, and prices are not just a function of what's happening to the supply of your money. They're also a function of industrial and market conditions. And so things are always getting cheaper, because we're always making more of everything. In spite of central banks' best attempts, everything's always getting cheaper in real terms. In fact, you know, there's a comparison called the Simon Index, in honor of Julian Simon, which looks at the abundance of goods in terms of human time in 2020 versus in 1980, so 40 years away. And with pretty much everything, you can make several multiples as much per minute of work today, because we just have so much more of everything. We have more coffee, more copper, more gold, more oil. Everything is becoming more abundant, because we're always producing more and more of everything. And so that should be reflected in dropping prices. Instead, we witness prices rising. And then, you know, we're gaslighted essentially by the same government that inflates the money supply into believing that no, prices are rising at the optimal 1 or 2 or 3%, which the economy needs for optimal performance, because they have calculated a basket of goods, which they call the consumer, from which they calculate the consumer price index. And that basket of, it's a representative basket of goods, as if such a thing could exist when, you know, there's no representative basket of goods because everybody's buying different things. And every year, you know, they run the numbers on this and then they come up with an estimate of it. But I think it's completely meaningless as an, well, not completely meaningless. It is, it does carry some meaning, but it is massively distorted because ultimately, I think the main issue, the fundamental unfixable issue, regardless of all of the quibbling about the details, is that you're performing measurement without a unit. And that's just absurd. There is, and of course, it's a very common absurdity repeated in macroeconomics textbooks, which is, you know, they measure utility without putting a unit on it. I remember when we'd when I would teach macroeconomics or microeconomics, then we'd perform all of these calculations on utility. And every now and then, you know, I'd have some engineering student in my class and they'd ask, but, you know, 14.3 to what? And that's when I, you know, I sit them down, I tell them, well, you know, they don't really like to talk about what the unit is, but sometimes they mention it as a thing called a util. But that's the absurdity of trying to make measurements without a unit, you know. Compare that to any other kind of measurement that we carry out. Imagine if you're trying to compare the height of two people, if you can't refer to a measurement unit, you know, whatever that unit is, there has to be some kind of unit. It could be a foot or a meter or something, but you need to be able to contrast that unit to the two things in order to perform measurement. So we don't have that with the CPI. What they try and do is effectively the CPI itself is the measuring unit for the value of the dollar, but the dollar is the measurement unit for the value of prices, or is the measurement unit for prices, and the CPI is the measurement unit for the value of the dollar. So you're measuring the CPI in what? It's meaningless. And of course, because it's meaningless, that's why you can get away with all kinds of sloppy and mendacious mathematics, basically, because you know, you're measuring ghosts in haunted houses, you know, so you can assume whatever you want and conclude whatever you want because you can't, you don't have a measurement unit with which you can reference it to. And so you can, you know, the problem with CPI is because you don't have a unit, you're just, you're performing, essentially circular reasoning, mathematical circular reasoning. It's like when you're in Excel and you have put in a circular reference where, the value of the cell is dependent on the value of the cell, but, you know, Excel tells you you're doing something wrong. But that doesn't stop government economists because they will measure the value of the dollar based on prices in the dollar. And the nonsense of it is that people's purchasing decisions are based on the value of the dollar. So you can't measure the value of the dollar based on people's purchases. In other words, if your salary is $1,000 a month and you spend it on goods that are worth $1,000, if the price of those goods goes up by tenfold overnight, you know, everything jumps in price by tenfold, what's the, you know, your basket of goods is going to remain very close to $1,000 because that's your income. And most people, of course, live hand to mouth these days. Nobody has any savings. So if the prices go up, you're still going to be spending $1,000 because that's all you have. And so if we measure the consumer price, if we measure the consumer price index based on the value of your basket of goods, we see that it's still $1,000. So there's no inflation. Of course, what we don't see is that you've changed the composition of goods in your basket of goods. And so my favorite example that I use in the book is you'll substitute ribeyes with soy burgers. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what's been happening with the dietary guidelines and with the way that people's diets have been going. You know, people are moving away from the most nutritious options because these are the most expensive foods because, you know, they contain a lot of nutrition and it takes a while to grow them, particularly red meat. And they're eating more industrial junk, essentially, you know, hydrogenated oils instead of animal fats and soy and pulses and beans instead of red meat. So if you substitute these cheap, inferior products for the healthier, more expensive products, then you don't see a lot of inflation. And not coincidentally, dietary guidelines encourage you to do this. And dietary guidelines tell you that, you know, you should just get your proteins. And a protein is a protein. It doesn't really matter if you get it from beef or soy. And it'll also tell you, oh, and by the way, you know, your beef is boiling the oceans and burning the planet and cow farts are going to destroy Earth. And so stay away from the expensive food and eat the cheaper food. This has been I think it's quite obvious if you look at it. This has been a strong motivation in American farm policy and American dietary policy. And there's quite a bit of evidence about it that because of inflation in the 1970s, one of the most important motivations of policy was to try and get food prices down. And, you know, obviously, as anybody who's read any economic history knows, they will try everything except for the one thing that actually works, which is cutting down the inflation.
Yeah, it really is something. And I got to tell you, the whole second part of this book, ladies and gentlemen, part one is fiat money. Part two is fiat life. And if you follow Saifedean on Twitter, which you should, you probably already have a sense of his perspective, not only on meat and dietary matters, but just on all the really sociology of what fiat does to us civilizationally. So that's really what part two of the book Fiat Life is all about, Saif. So I want to ask you, what prompted you to write this section? I mean, it's stuff that's likely to get you in trouble.
Yeah. Well, I mean, fortunately, I don't work in academia anymore. And so trouble for me consists of just people shouting on Twitter, and then I just block them and I move on with my life and I don't care.
Okay.
So I don't have to worry about getting canceled from anything. I cancel anybody who suggests canceling me preemptively. So, well, I mean, not to tempt fate too much, who knows. But I think, you know, this was a part of the Bitcoin standard, which was extremely popular. And when I was writing the Bitcoin standard, these were not very popular ideas or very commonly heard ideas. But for me, the most fascinating thing about Bitcoin, perhaps, is how it changes people's time preference. And this is something that I think explains why my book became so popular among Bitcoiners, because a very large number of them have experienced this shift to a lower time preference once Bitcoin got into their life. And I think it's something that I will discuss in more detail in Principles of Economics, but I also talk about in the fiat standard, which is ultimately time preference is the degree to which we discount the future. And when our money is hard and when our money has good saleability across time, as with gold or with Bitcoin, we have a relatively reliable way of providing for our future. And so therefore, the future becomes less uncertain. And so we're less likely to discount the future. We discount the future less and less. And that's why I think when people have hard money, you see civilization prosper because you see people, you know, thinking of the long term. They have a future they can plan for. A child can save. And when they're an adult, their savings are good enough for them to start a business or build a house. You know, they'll work their way up and watch the value of their money appreciate over time. And that kind of thing will make you invested in the future, will make you care about the future, and will tend to orient all of your behavior toward prospering in the long term. On the other hand, when you see the value of the money declining, your ability to provide for your future self is compromised. And so you're less likely to, you're more likely to discount the future. And so you're more likely to behave with a high time preference. And I think that reflects on all aspects of life, not just the economic in terms of saving and spending and debt and borrowing, but I think on all aspects of individual life. And, you know, the extreme case, of course, is hyperinflation. And if you've seen what happens in a hyperinflationary society, or if you read Adam Ferguson's When Money Dies, you see that people just discount the future very heavily. They get their paycheck, they run to spend it as fast as they can. And everybody is willing to do things that are very counterproductive for their long run in favor of the short run. So people start lying more, cheating, fighting, all kinds of social problems are magnified with inflation. And it's something you can see happening in Lebanon right now, and in Venezuela and in Zimbabwe. And I think not enough is mentioned about this. Obviously, fiat economists have a very strong vested interests in not discussing the impact of fiat money on time preference. But I think that's really the motivating idea. And it is something that I discussed in the Bitcoin Standard in Chapter 5 of the Bitcoin Standard, which was extremely popular. So here I thought, you know, I'm going to expand on it. And after several years of just thinking more about it, reading more about it, and being exposed to more Bitcoiners and hearing all the stories about how their time preference drops as they start figuring out, you know, maybe I should quit my drug habit and start buying more Bitcoin, and then maybe I should cut down on drinking and buy more Bitcoin. I think we can really think of it as money is like the operating system of society, and it pervades every transaction that we all do with one another, and it pervades every transaction that we do with our future selves. And it's impossible to argue, in my mind, the contrary, which is that the quality of money and your ability to send value to yourself in the future is not going to affect the way that you decide, that you make decisions. You know, when you have a harder money, you're just going to naturally think more and more about the future. So I think the 20th century, by moving toward fiat money, was just a global raising of time preference. Everybody's time preference just went up all over the world because everybody's money was being compromised. All throughout human history, you know, our time preference was dropping as we were moving toward harder and harder monies, as we were developing more advanced technologies for saving and better ways for providing for our future. And by the end of the 19th century, anybody in the world could save in a gold coin, which, you know, you could get paid in a gold coin and you could save it and hold on to it for 30 years. And 30 years later, you would expect it to have an even higher market value than when you held on to it. That was what the world was like pretty much everywhere by the end of the 19th century. And then by the end of the 20th century, that becomes almost unheard of. Nobody can save. And saving is just something that people do if they like to donate money to their government. It's just another way of taxing yourself. So you think about the consequences of that, and I think they're enormous. They reflect on family. You know, people have now less of an incentive to invest in a family because a family is a long-term project. You see it in architecture, I think. Buildings are probably the longest serving consumer goods that we have, the most durable consumer goods that we have. And so the longer the good is expected to serve, the more that discounting your future will affect decision you will take about the quality of investment that you will put into it. And so we see in the 20th century, architecture becomes much less durable, and it becomes, buildings become far more disposable almost. And it's because fiat money, you are discounting the future heavily. And so you don't put a lot of value on the building being there in 100 years from now. You care about the building right now. And so you will compromise for the long-term quality in order to enhance the short-term quality of the building. And we see the effect. You know, if you walk into any city, everybody likes to spend time in the old quarter of the city that was built in the 19th century, which is more friendly for pedestrians, and the buildings are, built to last, whereas the modern architecture is a very high time preference. And I mentioned the example of the Boston Library. The Boston Library, there was one that was built in the McKim building that was built in 1890s. It cost, in today's money, it cost $70 million to build it, and it's still around. And then in the 1970s, they built a another one, and that one cost something like, I forget how much it cost exactly at that time, but in recent decades, a decade or two ago, they had to renovate the new building. And that renovation alone cost $70 million. So you could have built a new McKim building, that one of the most beautiful buildings in Boston, one of the most important landmarks in Boston. You could have built it for the price of renovating the new modernist building. So it's not that it is cheaper. It's just that it is, it's not that modern architecture is cheaper. It's not economical. It is actually quite expensive, but it's optimized for the present, and it highly discounts the future. That's the difference between it and the old architecture. And then, you know, there's a couple of chapters on two issues which I find very important and quite underrated in their importance. The impact on food, which I spoke about earlier, and the dietary guidelines and all that. And then the impact on energy markets, which, similar to food, the prices of energy rose in the 1970s, and then they took them out of CPI. And so there was an enormous government push to fix the problem of rising energy costs by blaming it, obviously, on everything else, and by trying to replace the expensive energy, which is the energy that works, the energy that people want, which is, you know, hydrocarbons and fossil fuels, things that burn and provide a lot of power on demand when you want them. And the fuels that are really the key to our modern civilization and to our modern life, as these became expensive, we started promoting all of these, what I like to call fiat fuels, all of these pre-industrial technologies that cannot support an industrial civilization, but are being promoted and being shoved down people's throats with fiat regulations and rules and subsidies because of, you know, ultimately it's, you know, a confluence of interest groups. There's the initial hysteria was provided from, you know, the inflation, and then that's something that a lot of the environmentalists latched onto with the doomsday message of, we're going to destroy the planet if we keep consuming so much fuels for various reasons. You know, either we're going to run out of it, or there's too much of it that we're going to boil the oceans or whatever. But in any case, you know, there's this, you know, the environmental idea that humans are a burden on Earth and we need to be stopped. And so you get this coalition that has been pushing for all of these highly inefficient energy sources, solar, wind, and biofuels in particular. And, you know, this was something that I actually wrote my PhD on back in the distant past. And when I did it, I thought, you know, this is just another boondoggle in fiat politics, where a bunch of people like Al Gore and Elon Musk are going to be making a lot of money by manipulating people's emotions. It's just, you know, regular American politics. But now, more recently, I'm beginning to realize this is a serious threat to modern industrial civilization. And I don't think people quite realize just how devastating this would be, because most people think that we can replace hydrocarbons with solar, wind, and energy. In the same way you can take your iPhone to the shop and replace your black cover with a red cover, you know, you just go and pick whatever preference you have. But the reality is, this is more like replacing your iPhone with an iPhone made out of sticks and straws. It doesn't work that way. We need all of these materials for all of these essential industrial processes that we take for granted over the past couple of hundred years, but they make our lives possible. And what we're doing is we're subsidizing all these terrible, unreliable sources of energy that cannot support a modern industrial civilization, and decommissioning and fighting the reliable energy sources that have built modern civilization. And, you know, the result is what in my mind is just absolutely astonishing. You know, California, Texas, and New York, places that have had reliable 24-hour electricity for decades, are now normalizing the idea that, you know, when it gets too hot or when it gets too cold, your grid might not function.
Well, the whole part two of this book is remarkable. I recommend folks subscribe just to read this, because it's going to change your worldview. It's going to change the way you think about all kinds of cultural elements and their interrelationship with money and time and inflation. I think it's a really important section, although I'm sure the left will hate this, Saif. They'll say this is all sort of white supremacy or something, talking about time preference. But nonetheless, here we are. Part three is called The Fiat Liquidator. So just give us sort of a quick and dirty rundown. What is part three about in this, and how does it differ from your Bitcoin Standard book?
So the key operational feature of the fiat standard, which I discuss in part one, is that the process of fiat mining, you know, in Bitcoin, we mine Bitcoin using computers that run complicated mathematical problems. And with gold, they dig underground and process it and refine it, and then you get gold. Well, with fiat, the way that fiat is mined is that debt is created. So any financial institution that is backed by the central bank is able to issue fiat liabilities, and therefore is able to actually issue fiat. So they're actually creating new fiat tokens every time they're making more debt. So when you think about it this way, a lot of the fiat world begins to make sense. Why everybody is in debt, you know, individuals, companies, governments, everybody is in debt. And the more successful you are, you don't pay off your debt. You take on larger debts. That's how everybody more or less functions under the fiat standard. And if you don't function like that, you're effectively subsidizing everybody else taking on debt. And so with that in mind, the interesting thing about Bitcoin, the really powerful idea about it, which I hadn't really thought about thoroughly or discussed in the Bitcoin standard, is that Bitcoin is the monetization of a hard asset, similar to gold. And so with gold, you know, if you get paid with gold, gold is a final extinguisher of debt. You no longer, if I pay you with a gold coin, that gold coin has its value in it, and it no longer needs me to do anything. You don't have to rely on me to do anything in order for that gold coin to keep working. Whereas on the other hand, with fiat and with debt, if you're getting paid with debt instruments, there's always a counterparty liability. And so your money is, and the value that you have is dependent on other people fulfilling their obligations. Well, the reason that we got into the process of monetizing fiat and monetizing debt is because of the limitations of gold and the inability of gold to cross space very quickly. And so that gave central banks and governments, the people who can make debt, it made their credit effectively as good as gold. Because if they said, you know, they ran the only bank in town, and if that bank said, we have this much money for you, then that was as good as it's going to get. Whether the money's actually there or not is immaterial. It was their credit that was money. So Bitcoin is now allowing us to monetize something that is different from debt. And I think that's really the powerful aspect of it, because it, as it grows, you know, we're witnessing a parallel monetary system built on a hard asset growing next to the fiat monetary system, which is built on a highly inflationary credit base. And that credit is just constantly expanding, and the supply of the money is constantly expanding, and the value stored in it is constantly dissipating. Whereas a value stored in Bitcoin is constantly getting amplified because of what I like to call Bitcoin's number go up technology. The supply is limited, and so more demand just continues to raise the price upwards. So Bitcoin basically allows us to liquidate the fiat system in a neat and orderly manner, I hope, potentially. You know, it could get ugly, but I think there's a peaceful coexistence scenario where, you know, fiat continues to operate as it is, and Bitcoin is just the lifeboat that continues to grow and people jump from the Titanic onto the lifeboat, but the lifeboat eventually becomes much bigger than the Titanic. And, basically anybody can jump off the Titanic onto the lifeboat at any point in time. So I'm sure a lot of people are going to suffer from the Titanic, but at this point, 10 years into Bitcoin's operation, you're basically choosing to stay on the Titanic at this point. And the alternative is there. The lifeboat is better and bigger than the Titanic, and it's ready and it's waiting for you. So it could be not so terrible, because as the value stored in fiat declines in real terms because of inflation, people can compensate for it by upgrading and moving to Bitcoin.
You know, Saif, I thought there was a little bit of a parallel. You talk about the money supply in some of your earlier chapters, especially chapter 6, where I might add you do a nice takedown of fractional reserve. But this idea that we have to worry about the money supply, and I think there's a little bit of a parallel here where you say, you know, it's not really about scaling Bitcoin. We always hear this all the time. Somehow it needs to scale so that it can become some worldwide day-to-day transactional currency. And you say, no. What's required of Bitcoin is that it simply survives long enough. So talk a little bit about that. What were you intending to tell us there?
I think ultimately Bitcoin's success is, I think a lot of people, particularly fiat people, they think of money purely as the token that you use in order to exchange value amongst people. And I think that's almost a trivial function for money, because we already have all kinds of payment systems that can work with whatever asset you have behind them. So, PayPal now has Bitcoin. And this is something that when I set it in the Bitcoin standard, that was kind of heretic at that point, and many people thought that was crazy. But here we are. There isn't a single fiat payment rail that cannot be run on top of Bitcoin. We can have Visa run Bitcoin. They already run, 100 currencies or something like that. They already provide payments in 100 different currencies. Bitcoin would just be one extra currency that they add, and they just need to have a market maker buying and selling Bitcoin from Bitcoin exchanges, and that's it. They'll be able to provide it. So the payment aspect of it is almost not interesting, because if there is demand for transactions in Bitcoin, there will be millions of ways found in order for people to transact with Bitcoin. And that won't be on the base layer. There is a strict limit to how much transactions we can fit on chain. And that's already probably something like 10% of all Bitcoin transactions. When you think about how many transactions take place on exchanges and Bitcoin-based websites, a lot more transactions take place on secondary layers than on-chain. So for me, the growth of Bitcoin, the scaling of Bitcoin, is primarily about cash balances. It's how much of the world's cash balances Bitcoin are in Bitcoin. And currently, this is somewhere in the range of, depending on how you calculate cash balances and if you count bonds or not, but it's somewhere between 0.1 and 0.5% or something like that. So it's still very early days in that regard. But and that's why, most people don't get paid in Bitcoin and they don't make payments in Bitcoin, because for the vast majority of people, Bitcoin is a small percent of their cash balances. And the likelihood of coming across somebody, or even if it is a large percent, the likelihood of coming across somebody who wants to buy or sell the same thing that you want to buy and sell, and also wants to buy and sell Bitcoin at this point, is not very high, because there's just not that many people with a lot of Bitcoin balances that they can trade with at the margin. Most people have zero Bitcoin. Now, as cash balances in Bitcoin increase, that's going to lead to more and more trade opportunities between people with Bitcoin, and we're going to see Bitcoin transactions increase more and more. But ultimately, I think it's really about just growth in the cash balances and the value of cash balances. And of course, Bitcoin's superpower here is that it goes against the Keynesian dogma, which is the way to grow is to make more money, to print more money. Bitcoin doesn't print more money. The supply, we're almost at 90% of the supply has already been produced now. And so over the next century, we're only going to make another 10% of all the Bitcoins. You know, 90% were made in the last 12 years, and the last 10% are going to take another century or so. So it's the supply is not increasing, but the value of the cash balances is increasing precisely because the supply is not increasing, because that guarantees that the value goes up, or at least makes the value likely to go up. And so people will more and more likely want to move to that. And I think that's really the secret weapon that Bitcoin has. Well, it's not very secret, but that's the weapon that it has.
Well, before I let you go, I just wanted to touch on something biographical. And, you know, you have a degree from London School of Economics. You have a PhD from Columbia. You taught at Lebanese American University. So you've seen things from the inside. What is fiat academia, and how did you end up escaping it? How come you didn't stay?
Fiat academia, and I'd have a whole chapter on fiat science in the book. It's, I think the way that I explain it functionally, if you wanted to really apply economic analysis to how to, and to understand the incentives, is that funding comes from government, and it comes from government committees that assign funding to universities and provide loans to students. And so success is not measured on the market. You don't have to provide people with something valuable, whether it is, you know, knowledge that they benefit from individually or for businesses. You're not being judged on by how much you contribute to society on the market. You're being judged by a bunch of bureaucrats with boxes to tick. And so what that has led to is that universities and those funding bodies have to agree on kind of objective criteria, you know, because there's no market. You're trying to centrally plan. And so we're back at the calculation problem. You know, the calculation problem applied to academia is essentially the fiat science chapter. You have that calculation problem. So how do they solve it? How do those academics and those funding bodies get around it? The answer was publications in academic journals. And so they start putting scores and points on the journal quality and then the kind of paper that you publish, and that gives you a certain number of points. And then the more points you get, the more you can advance and the better the university you can go to. And then the university that has people getting more points on in publishing in all of these journals, these universities end up getting more and more funding. And so the result is it's very similar to what Mises describes in the collapse of Soviet production, the collapse of socialism, which, you know, he described decades before it happened, which is, you know, the factories that are operating and the people who show up to work and who go to the factories, but they go to the job, but the factories produce nothing, and all economic production is stalling because there are no price signals and there's no economic calculation possible. And that's kind of where academia is right now. We have massive overproduction of research papers. We have an infinite number of journals that are producing an infinite number of articles that nobody reads. So the metric by which the bureaucracy judges is obviously shooting through the roof. You know, there isn't any single person who can keep up with all of the journals in their field. You could, if you were an economist, you would not have enough hours of the day to read all the papers that are published in economic journals throughout the year. It's just impossible. There's so many of them, but it doesn't matter. Nobody reads them. And the point is to just tick the methodological boxes and tick the politically correct boxes and, you know, write grammatically correct sentences. And then you get the points and then you advance. And so we have this entire paper mill that's producing papers that don't need to offer any relation to reality. And that's why academia is so unhinged from reality, really, because there's no market test. And instead, people are just writing things that satisfy the bureaucracy. And so, this is something that I'd noticed when I was in academia. You know, you keep expecting that the more you read, the more you're going to understand. But the more you read, the more inexplicably long and complicated papers you're coming across and not arriving at any profound conclusion out of it. And later on, you realize, yeah, these people, the point of these papers is not to communicate anything useful to the reader. The point of these papers is to give the person who wrote it a promotion. That's what it is about. And so this is why, in my mind, you know, you look at what academia has degenerated into, whether it's the science of nutrition or the science of climate or the science of, you know, medical hysteria, as we saw last year. It's just, it's a very far cry from what people think universities are and from what universities were in the 19th century. It's, the modern scholar is completely different from what people think a scholar should actually be.
Well, a lot of that goes to the heart, I think, of this very book. It is called The Fiat Standard, The Debt Slavery Alternative to Human Civilization. You can actually read along and get your own copy at safedean.com. I encourage you to do so and to join his insider group. I also encourage you to follow him on Twitter, Dr. Safedean Amos. So, Safe, it's great to talk to you. I want to thank you so much for your time, and I really hope to see you somewhere soon after all this COVID stuff is calmed down.
Thank you so much, Jeff. It's a pleasure to be on the show again and to talk to you.